Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a geophysicist. Now, we've met geophysicists before, and I think you'll probably remember the general gist of what they do is they go out somewhere, put explosives into the ground, go bang, and then watch the waves emanate from that particular source and learn something about the substructure of the Earth. This gentleman, his name is Ben Drenth. He's from the U.S. Department of the Interior and the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver. And he does something very different. He does what is in the trade called passive geophysics or gentle geophysics. So, gentle Ben, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get into this distinction about passive, gentle geophysics, no explosions, etc., let's learn a little bit about Ben. How did you become a scientist? Because you're a scientist.
That's right. So as a kid, I was always interested in science and math. It took me a while to figure out exactly what I wanted to do with that. But when I started college, it quickly became clear that I really enjoyed earth science. And then it was a question of what type of earth science to do. And it took several years and a couple graduate careers, but I eventually figured it out.
Well, tell us about that, because
sure.
Most people don't have a couple of graduate degrees.
Sure. Well, I started out as an undergrad at Michigan Tech University in northern Michigan. I'm from northern Michigan originally. Interested in lots of different things, rocks and minerals, groundwater, mineral deposits, and eventually found that geophysics was something I was really interested in doing. Ended up coming here for my master's degree. Worked at Big Bend National Park, which was a lot of fun. And that was what really sealed the deal.
It's a lot of fun in the winter.
In the winter, exactly.
Yeah, it's fun in the summer.
No, I never went in the summer. Coming from northern Michigan, I don't really like hot weather. But I would, as you say, I spent a lot of time down there in January and February doing field work, which is a pretty wonderful time. And that's what really sold me on making a career out of this type of geophysics, doing that type of thing.
So anyway, you're a local boy in one sense.
In a sense.
To the El Paso area. I don't know much about geology. I took a minor. But I do know in northern Michigan, I think that's one of the rare places in the world where you can find native copper.
Absolutely.
Right? And there was a whole Native American community there who,
in fact,
were ahead of the game. They had metals. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because
sure.
You must know something about that.
Sure. So that's in the Keweenaw Peninsula. Of the western which is a sub-peninsula, if you will, of the western upper peninsula of Michigan. And yes, there are significant world-famous native copper deposits there that we know that Native Americans mined prehistorically. And then in the mid-1800s, those deposits were, we'll say, rediscovered by folks from Michigan that in the Michigan Geological Survey. And then that was... eventually became pretty quickly became a big copper boom in the late 1800s. So that pretty remote part of Michigan was booming country about 100 years ago and produced huge amounts of copper for the country.
Yeah, I mean, copper, silver, and gold, they're all in the same group of the periodic table, but copper is much more reactive. You don't tend to find native copper.
That's
native
right.
Silver, native gold, of course,
right.
You can find in many, many places.
Right.
What was special about the geology of northern Michigan that allowed this to happen?
Well, you're right. It is exceedingly rare to have native copper like that, especially in such large quantities. And frankly, it's still not that well understood what the, especially geochemical conditions there were to emplace those deposits there. But they are very special, definitely.
So it's still an unsolved...
It's still... There are
hypotheses,
there are many hypotheses out there.
Many theses, I bet.
That's right. But there's nothing that's been, I would say, overwhelmingly universally accepted as a grand explanation for why those are there.
Where else in the world can you get such deposits?
I don't know myself, but I know that they are exceedingly rare.
And you've been there?
Well, I've been to the Keweenaw Peninsula, certainly.
Right.
That's actually where Michigan Technological University is. So I spent quite a bit of time right there. And my undergraduate field geology was working on those rocks.
All right, lovely.
Yeah.
And do you have samples?
Oh, sure. I have plenty of copper at home, yeah.
I've got some beautiful silver samples from the Chihuahua Mountains area, the Sierra Madre.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, anyway, so that's an interesting sideline. So you got into this area of geophysics because, A, you enjoy geology, but then you mentioned earlier in the program you're a bit of a math person too.
Sure.
And this combination, I think, is quite rare.
I don't think I want to say it's rare, but a geophysicist should have a good grounding in math and physics, obviously, but also in geology, because the ultimate goal is to use geophysics to learn more about the Earth, especially parts of the Earth that we care about that are buried, that we can't see. Field geologists can't go out and map it.
Right.
And that's where geophysicists can come in and help get an idea of what the subsurface looks like.
So this is the same trick that people do in what I will call non-passive or aggressive geophysics.
Right.
But now this concept of passive, gentle geophysics.
Sure.
What do we do? What do you do? Sorry.
Well, perhaps the easiest way is to contrast it with the seismic methods that people are most familiar with. In a seismic method, as you said, you have some kind of energy source, often an explosive or other type of energy source, and you're looking at the sound waves as they propagate through the Earth. We call that an active method. So you're actively putting a source of energy into the ground. Passive methods, we're just measuring the Earth's natural fields. So in the case of what we call the gravity method, we're measuring very slight disturbances in the Earth's gravitational field intensity. Nothing that you could feel walking around. We're talking about parts per million of the field. But we can measure and resolve those slight variations. We call them anomalies. And it turns out you can interpret quite a bit of subsurface geology on the basis of that. The other example are magnetic methods, where we're measuring slight anomalies in the Earth's magnetic field. And in a similar way to the gravity method, we can infer magnetic properties of the buried subsurface.
So I seem to recall many years ago reading an article or hearing about a project where they were doing this gravity analysis, mm-hmm. but from airplanes.
Absolutely, yes.
That's the way that you have to do it. Not have to, but you can cover a bigger area.
You can, yeah. Both of these types of methods are most effectively done from airborne platforms because you can cover more ground more quickly and you get uniform coverage. And you don't have to worry about private property, things of that nature. The sky is in the public domain, as
we
like
to say. Even in Texas. Wander all over these great ranches with impunity.
That's right. We might get shot at, but you can. theoretically, it's legal.
Okay.
But these methods can also be used on the ground as well. I mean, that's certainly possible. In fact, gravity traditionally is done on the ground. It's pretty expensive to do it airborne, whereas magnetics, on the other hand, for technological reasons, is pretty cheap to do airborne.
Okay, well, So then let's go through those two technologies.
Sure.
The gravity one, what's the experiment?
Mm-hmm.
What's the setup? What are you just weighing a piece of standard material in different locations around the world?
Exactly right. Oh. We have something called a gravity meter,
right,
or a gravimeter. And if you go over to the geology building, talk to Galen Cape, and he can show you a gravity meter and talk to you all about that. And it's exactly what you said. You have a mass on the end of a spring. Of course, it's extremely finely calibrated to measure the anomalies to parts per million intensity of the total Earth's field. But yes, we literally go around the surface of the Earth with that for groundwork and measure the field intensity that way.
So this is now all hooked up to a computer. It's not like you're reading a scale yourself and right, to find out the mass of this material.
Well, yes and no. Modern gravity meters are sort of self-contained instruments and computers. However, we still use a lot of the older meters that were designed and built in the 1950s and 60s that are still very robust. In some ways, are more convenient than the more modern ones. And those are pretty, well, we might look at it and think that's a rather blunt analog instrument, but it's still a very useful instrument today. And so you're literally out there writing in your field book the measurements. They're not recorded anywhere else. There's different possibilities, sure.
Presumably, and if you're weighing anything and you have a little rumble, right, of a truck going by or an earthquake, so you could sit in a spot for a long time, perhaps, especially if it's an area where earthquakes or something of that nature can occur. So stability has to be a major issue here.
Stability is paramount. So an example for my Big Bend work, people remember the 2004 Sumatran earthquake that caused the horrible tsunami. Well, some folks might remember a few months later, the following March, there was almost as big of an earthquake in that same region. It did not generate a tsunami, so it wasn't in the news as much. It was a very large earthquake, and those waves, earthquakes, anywhere in the world, those waves reverberate around the entire Earth, and that routinely shuts down gravity work for a half a day or so. Well, I had a day at Big Bend that was shut down for over 24 hours because of that large earthquake. I had to wait for the Earth to stop rumbling. So even in Texas, we could see the effects of that, even if you couldn't feel them, of course.
Well, I mean, and for example, I've done programs with geophysicists before. You know, we're on the Rio Grande Rift right here.
That's right. And
it's an active earthquake area in terms of earthquakes in the sort of scale of two, maybe three. Mm-hmm. But they're quite common, right?
Sure, they do. They do happen, yeah.
And so, therefore, anywhere around the world, there's enough earthquakes going on that your windows of opportunity are somewhat restricted in this game.
I would say in a typical week of gravity surveying or gravity work, you might lose on average half of a day to an earthquake. To earthquake somewhere in the world causes it big enough.
You can do this at nighttime too.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
So in fact, Big Bend at night might be better than Big Bend during the day.
That's right. You might get run over by one of the massive jackrabbits, but yeah, sure.
How big is a jackrabbit in Big Bend?
They're pretty big. They're pretty scary.
I've never seen one. I mean, are we talking a foot, 2 feet?
Oh, maybe a foot. They're huge.
And
I don't know what they're doing down there, but they have big rabbits.
And they don't seem to worry about people like you.
They don't seem to.
Okay.
No.
Have you had any interesting experiences like that, actually? You know, when you're out there on your own? Because it's quite lonely down there.
Yeah, it can be. I had a mountain lion walk into a camp one night. We scared it away.
Oh, so you camp. You don't stay in the
sometimes, yeah.
hotel that's down there.
Well, we like to stay in a hotel.
Or something.
Mostly because we like to plug in the instruments to recharge overnight, but sometimes you have to camp.
Of course. All your instruments then must be battery.
That's right. The battery operated.
Ah.
Yeah.
And you never made a mistake? Thought he'd charged it and hadn't?
Not yet, but it's just a matter of time because mistakes always happen.
Absolutely. Well, we don't make mistakes on Science Studio. We take a break in the middle. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Ben Dranth. He's a passive geophysicist from the U.S. Geological Survey. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. The medieval Black Death killed an enormous number of people, one-third to one-half of all Europeans. Yet, a recent article argues the plague benefited us. But how?
The survivors may have passed on genes that benefit us to this day. Researchers studied the skeletal remains of plague victims, which wasn't difficult since they were in designated plague cemeteries.
Those skeletons were compared with skeletons from other cemeteries of the same era. They found that older people died at higher rates from the plague, which is natural selection's way of removing the weakest part of the population.
The surprising find was when they looked beyond the plague's dominant years and saw people were living longer. In medieval times, 50 was considered old age, so children of parents or grandparents who survived the plague had a better chance of living to an older age.
They inherited genes that gave their ancestors an advantage in surviving the plague. The impact of the selection imposed by the Black Death led to 200 years of increased lifespan in the general population.
Another advantage they passed on was the selection for a gene variant in Europeans called CCR5 Delta 32 allele. It's associated with people who show a higher resistance to HIV/AIDS. So pandemics can have a profound effect on the evolution of human populations.
Take the latest Ebola crisis. 70% die while 30% survive. What genomic attributes do the survivors possess that give them an advantage scientists could use to develop a therapeutic?
Ebola, just like the medieval plague, may be causing an evolution of the human genome in modern times.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Ben Dranth from the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver. He's a geophysicist. He is a passive geophysicist. And we were talking earlier about the use of gravity anomalies. You know, the gravity of the Earth changes simply because of the nature of what's in between the middle and where you are doing measurements. For example, igneous dense rocks will give a different reading if you're above that compared to a sedimentary sandstone, et cetera, et cetera.
Precisely.
So, Ben, tell us an example where this gravity measurement has sort of shown something to the researcher, yourself, that we didn't know by the usual aggressive seismic geophysics.
Sure. So, well, I can bring up an example, a comparison of the two. Seismic methods are very good at a local, resolving the local subsurface structure right underneath your survey. But, of course, they're limited spatially to a very large degree. It's wherever you can get your geophones and sources.
Geophones.
Those are the sensors that pick up the seismic waves.
Oh, that's lovely. Telephones, geophones.
Exactly. Yeah. Gravity, on the other hand, has lower resolution power at specific places. However, it gives you a much bigger, broader picture, more context. So a local example are the basins or bolsons in the Rio Grande Rift. And they're all over the rift, not just around here. But the communities of the Southwest, like El Paso and Albuquerque, they're obviously in a very dry climate. So that means we rely on groundwater to keep these communities going, literally. So that water comes from these bolsons. And the gravity method is very good at mapping out the geometry of those bolsons, how deep they are, how big they are. And those are fundamental constraints or boundary conditions that feed into groundwater models that groundwater engineers worry about, as far as how much water can we extract, how quickly, from what part of the bolson to keep communities like El Paso alive with enough water.
Let me get that right. So you can talk about the geometry and the structure of the bolson.
Mm-hmm.
That's because of the rocks that form the boundary.
That's right.
And the water inside, you can also measure the volumes. I mean, in a sense, you can say, well, you know, this bolson is filled up to such and such a locale.
Mm-hmm.
So you can measure the volume of the water using this technology.
There's two different answers there. The basic geometry of the bolson, we can map using the gravity method because the sediments that fill the basin, the bolson, which have the groundwater, are lower density than the surrounding rocks. We call those the basement rocks. So you see these, we call the gravity low. Over the bolsons. And modeling those lows gives you an idea of the geometry. Now, the second answer, can you monitor groundwater, how much water is there? We can monitor groundwater withdrawal using repeated gravity measurements in the same location over time. And there are folks that are experts in exactly that type of application that is used in the Southwest United States.
Does that imply that there's a permanent station there?
It doesn't have to be permanent. It can be. But the key is repeated measurements over time in the same location.
Well, in fact, that comes back to the whole concept of experiment in science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one reads recently about all sorts of papers that have been published and that have called into question even retraction of scientific articles because they cannot be reproduced elsewhere.
Right.
Now, in this case, you go out there, you're down there in the Big Bend, and it's nice and it's wonderful and there's no vibrations, and you take a measurement. How many measurements do you take before you actually say, now I've got a value that is reliable?
Sure. So it typically takes me about 5 minutes per station. We call it a station in one location. And I'll take 3 to 5 readings. If they're obviously precise, if they're on top of each other or close to each other, we'll say, then I'll say I'm satisfied and I'll move on to the next station.
So when you say
station.
You take a reading.
Sure.
I haven't seen this instrument.
Right.
But I mean, you've got a mass.
Right.
And you've got a mass that you're measuring on the screen.
Right.
Now, what do? Shake it up and then let it settle again or pick it up, move it around? I mean, how do you do an individual reading?
Sure.
I mean, I stand on a scale and it says 160. It doesn't actually. It says more like 173. But I don't sort of get off it and put it back on again because that's good enough.
Right.
In your case, you've got to do something. What is that something that you do to get another reading?
Sure. So when you're taking a reading, the meter has to be perfectly vertical. And the meter, I know you can't see it, but it's think of an overgrown coffee pot type of size instrument. It has to be perfectly vertical. And then the mass, because it's so sensitive, normally the mass is locked. so it doesn't shake around and damage itself. So once you get the meter perfectly vertical, you unlock the mass, and you look through an eyepiece, and you take a reading. There's a little scale on there, and you adjust it till it's just right. And then you repeat that whole process a few times to make sure everything's... make sure everything's working properly, and it's your readings are consistent. That way you know things are functioning right.
So on a given day, when you're down there, how many readings do you take, and how far apart is it that you need to be to get the information you need?
Sure. So it depends on how many readings can you take a day. It depends on what you're doing. If you're hiking with your instrument.
With an oversized coffee pot.
Right. Plus GPS equipment that goes along with it because we need to survey in pretty precisely. You can work all day and get only a handful of stations. However, if we're driving in a vehicle on a good road, I've been able to get 40, 50 stations a day.
Okay.
So you're really limited by – you're not limited by the reading time. You're limited by the time between measurements. Now, how far apart do those need to be? It depends on the scale of the geological problem you're looking at. If you're looking at something very near surface and small, you need very tight station spacing, maybe every 100 meters. But I've also done what we call regional work or broad-scale work where I go every mile or so.
Okay, so it depends upon the underlying terrain, I see.
Underlying terrain, the geology is the local geology as well as the particular problem you're trying to attack.
Okay, so that's one passive form of geophysics. Mm-hmm. And the other you said is this variation of the magnetic field.
Yes,
how does that one work?
Sure. So you're back in World War II, we were very concerned about German U-boats, right, sinking our merchant and naval vessels as we're helping out Great Britain.
The supply line to my favorite town, London.
That's right, exactly. And the technology for magnetometers had been around before that, but it saw rapid development during World War II, and it was for submarine hunting. You might be aware of, even today, naval aircraft that are submarine hunters. They have a big thing sticking off the aircraft somewhere, off the front or the back, and it's a magnetometer. And they're looking for the magnetic field generated by a metal submarine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, so during that time in World War II, we...
So a plastic submarine would go on...
A plastic submarine would be an advantage
okay.
for the whoever has a submarine, obviously. Well, it was noticed back during World War II, in addition to finding or not finding submarines, we're seeing very interesting anomalies. And this was found by the British and U.S. People developing the technology. And it turns out those were due to the magnetic seafloor. So these are the – if you're familiar with the story of plate tectonics, these are the famous seafloor magnetic stripes that show reversals of the Earth's magnetic field. Well, it turns out we can apply that method to all sorts of geological problems.
You mean that reversal of the magnetic poles was only observed in 1940 or in that period of time? Hadn't been seen before?
I'm not sure exactly when it was first observed, but it was first observed on a large scale and well mapped. We had finally had good images of it coming out of World War II. And it was at that point that geophysicists really started taking note and saying, okay, what does this mean? And that's one of the fundamental things that led to the development of the theory of plate tectonics.
If you go down to Big Bend again and do a magnetic, or anywhere in the world,
sure.
What are you learning from that particular technology? I mean, okay, so there are variations. Are you looking at these reversals, or are you looking at various intensities? What is it you measure, and what have you learned?
Yes, all of the above. So different types of rocks have different magnetic intensity. They generate anomalies of various shapes and amplitudes depending on the type of rock and the configuration of the rocks, as well as structure, things like faults. We can frequently image using this method. We're also, in many rock types of rocks, especially volcanic rocks, able to image reversals. So, for example, down at Big Bend, there are lots of reversely magnetized or reversely polarized rocks that produce large amplitude anomalies, but they produce magnetic lows because their fields are reversed, opposite to the present-day Earth's field direction, which we call normal. Those aren't weakly magnetized rocks. They're actually very strongly magnetized rocks, just in an opposite direction. So reversals is one of the fundamental things we can use to interpret the geology.
So this reversal, I let me get it right. I know there's north-south poles, and by miraculous mechanisms, they exchange. But your rock is already there.
That's right.
Right. And so when the poles change, what is it you see? That, you know, how do you know what's happening? I don't quite get it.
That's fine. So the easiest example is volcanic rocks. They flow out on the surface of the earth. They cool quickly, turn from a lava into a hard rock. And when they do that, they acquire a strong, what we call, remnant magnetization in the Earth's field direction at whatever direction that was when the rocks cooled. Okay? That's a more or less a permanent magnetization.
That I can understand.
Yeah. Right. And then it doesn't matter what the Earth's field does after that.
Right.
So we can still see the permanent or remnant magnetization of volcanic rocks that are very old, billions of years old. They retain that.
But the regular deposits, like sandstone deposits or limestones or whatever, when they get deposited, they have a permanent magnetic fingerprint.
They do.
Right? And that won't change.
That won't change.
So the reversals that you're looking at are from different periods of time. It's not within one rock. It's one deposit on top of another, which you're looking at.
Yeah, that's a fair way of thinking about it. Absolutely.
Okay. So what did you learn? What have you learned? What's the big sort of poster child for magnetic passive geophysics?
Well, I can say it's a very well-accepted technique that's very useful in all sorts of geologic environments to help us map the geology because of different rock types and different rock configurations.
Something you can point to say, if it wasn't for that technique, we wouldn't have known that particular information?
There are countless examples of different mineral deposits around the world that were discovered using the method, both directly and indirectly. And what I mean by directly is the ore rock itself is very magnetic. We imaged it directly using those means. Or indirectly, the magnetic method helped us map the geology around the deposit such that a light bulb went on in a geologist's head and said, that's where I should drill because that's where a mineral deposit should be. So there are many examples like that.
So is that still a viable technology these days for mining companies?
They absolutely.
Have their own airplanes scouring the world?
Absolutely. That is a first-order bread-and-butter tool of mineral exploration. A lot of petroleum exploration companies use it as well to explore basins in a very broad sense.
And so, since the technology is getting better and better, they go over the same place, you know, every 10 years maybe, because the resolution could be better now.
Resolution is very good, although it hasn't. The most recent major improvement was with the advent of GPS technology on the aircraft.
So they know where they are.
Exactly. It sounds trivial, but it's actually very important to getting errors down and producing very high-precision maps of the magnetic field.
Well, this has been a wonderful program. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself, and I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
Yeah.
I hope the listeners have enjoyed you. You've been listening to Ben Dranth. He's from the United States Geological Survey up there in Denver, talking about passive or non-seismic geophysics. It's been really very entertaining and educational. I've learned an awful lot, but I didn't know much to begin with, I must say. And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez, as usual, for putting the program together. And we'd like to thank you out there for listening and hope you'll be back next week for another Science Studio. Bye-bye.